It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
This week, President Trump addressed the nation as the country braces for the spread of the coronavirus, which has already topped 1,000 cases. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Even with promises of more test kits, local and state governments are scrambling to meet the challenge. There have been a number of cases in Maryland as the governor announces new emergency measures. Meanwhile, Wicomico County health officials are putting in place measures to control the disease. And on the hospital side, the Peninsula Regional Medical Center is gearing up to handle an outbreak. With us in the studio this morning, Dr. Charles Sylvia. He's the chief medical officer for the Peninsula Regional Medical Center. And Olivia Butler. She's the programming manager for communicable disease. And welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Olivia, I want to start with you. How serious at this point is the disease in Wicomico County in specifics, as well as Maryland in general? We've had obviously a number of cases, but I don't think I've spotted anything yet on the Eastern Shore. What are we looking at?
Yeah, we haven't seen any cases here yet on the Eastern Shore, but we are doing our very best to monitor and evaluate people that may have symptoms that suggest possible infection. We're reviewing all of those and talking with the state about them and trying to get testing done if it's warranted for those. So we are working very hard with the hospital and local providers to do that.
In terms of testing, is there has any testing been done? And I understand that tests are at the state level. What's going on with that?
There have been tests that we have sent out, and some of those are still pending, and some we have had results back that are negative.
Mm-hmm. And how does one get a test? I mean, what's the criteria?
Well, they would have to talk with their provider. If somebody is sick, it's suggested that they call ahead to let them know what's going on with them so they can get instructions on what to do when they come to the office. Or if they end up in the ER, an urgent care center, their symptoms are evaluated. We look at certain risk factors, like if they've traveled or been around large groups where we've identified cases in the United States. We rule out other illnesses like flu. And then if they meet those criteria, then they could possibly get tested.
So in terms of symptoms, what are we looking at? And how does one distinguish between, say, the virus itself and, say, a cold or even a flu? I mean, how does one know the difference?
Well, they are very similar symptoms. The main symptoms we're looking at with this are fever, shortness of breath, and cough. Now, that's not to say somebody might have others or may not have some of those. So it's really important that they're evaluated and other things are ruled out, too. Because we are still seeing some flu in the community. So that would be one of the first things that they should try to rule out.
How, if someone has some of these symptoms, how, what's a tipping point for them saying, I got to go in and check it out? Or do we really know?
Well, what I would recommend is if it's just fever and cough, sneezing, that sort of thing, you stay home. Mm-hmm. If you have significant trouble with your breathing, that's when we start to get worried. And that's when you should be, you know, come to the doctor and get checked out more, you know, more aggressively.
Is there any real treatment for this, or is it just simply palliative?
Well, it's not palliative, but but it's supportive. You know, we have, you know, medications that help breathing, we have oxygen, and in the worst case, ventilator support until the person can rid themselves of the virus.
And what populations are we looking at in terms of who might be most vulnerable? Olivia?
Well, what we have seen when we've looked at cases that have occurred in other parts of the world, the people that are getting sick are and getting more severe symptoms of it are the elderly and people that have underlying medical conditions that they're normally at greater risk for things anyway. You know, it is still affecting some of the other ages, but they're not getting as sick.
And when I was reading about that, one of the things that struck me is that we have retirement homes, we have nursing homes, a number of them. What kind of coordination is being taken there? What kind of preparations just to make sure that this doesn't spread amongst their population?
Right. I know that locally, the nursing homes for the last few weeks have been looking at what they plan to do to prevent any infection in their facilities. And I know this week a lot of them have put into place visitor restrictions or going down to no visitation. to kind of prevent that. If they do have visitors come in, it's limited. They're screening them upon entry to the facility. I know some of them have put into place things like Skype or FaceTime, so family can still interact with their family members that are in there, but not come in and expose them.
So, Dr. Sibby, we've talked a lot about social distancing. Mm-hmm. How should people change their habits?
Well, again, it's spread by contact or in the air when you cough or sneeze. So the more we can stay away from large crowds, the more we can stay at least 6 feet away from each other, avoid people that are sick. They're obviously sick coughing. Just try to stay away from people in general. It's very hard to do. People have to live and work and go to the grocery store and all that, but we really try to limit it as much as possible. And if you do start feeling sick, you really got to triple your effort to stay away from others, including your family as best you can, especially if you have elderly relatives, because like she says, they are very vulnerable. After over 60 and other comorbid problems is really scary.
Well, why is it the elderly are more susceptible?
We don't really know for sure yet, but their immune systems are typically weaker. And there's a lot of research going on with this. Again, this is a new thing for us in general. And a lot of the research so far has been in foreign countries, not in the United States. You know, we've just had this in the last couple of weeks, so we don't know for sure. But again, elderly are usually the most vulnerable, for anything that we get. Mm. So if your immune system's weaker, if you're ill with diabetes or COPD or heart disease, those kind of things, it puts you in a weakened state, and that's you're just more vulnerable.
In terms, by the way, in terms of the state, obviously they're declared emergency. There have been cases in Maryland. What kind of coordination is there with state government? What are there things that you're hoping to get from the state government outside of obviously the testing that they're going to do? I mean, what's kind of coordination is it at this point? Discussions?
Well, I mean, there is a lot of coordination between us, the state health department, our health officer, and people within the government, and we've tried to be, I guess, as best as we can, working with everybody. We've had some meetings with other agencies and county, city government to try to figure out, you know, what their plans are. Do they have needs that they have if they maybe don't have the workforce, or just to start thinking about what they're going to do? Because now, you know, we have schools that are closed, so people need to have plans in place on what they're going to do with their children so that they can continue to work. Or if there's jobs where they're able to work from home, we've been doing that over the past week or two, trying to get these places out in the community to think about what they're going to do. We are in communication almost daily with somebody from the state health department for whatever, and then they have frequent calls that they're doing updates with us. So there's a lot of communication and coordination going on between us, the state, city, county.
Is there any expectation to be any kind of limitation in number of people can gather in any given place, or what you're thinking at this point?
Well, I think now what they're saying is that large gatherings over 250 people should be stopped for right now. And then other gatherings, I think they're just looking at, you know, if you don't need to gather, you probably shouldn't. And if there are gatherings, then, you know, those people that are at increased risk probably really should consider not going to them. You know, the elderly, the ones with underlying medical conditions. If, you know, there's still things that are going on and we haven't really put a restriction on everything, those people still need to be cognizant of what's going on in the community and try to protect themselves.
So, Dr. Sibby, I guess one of the other questions is obviously if this thing does pick up speed, the hospitals are going to be sort of on the front line. I was looking at some statistics. There's something like 160,000 available ventilators, I guess, in the country, kept by hospitals and the government. Some 45,000 ICU beds in the nation. A moderate outbreak, though, could say 200,000 might need those kinds of beds. You're at a hospital. It's a fairly small population. What do you think when you look at those statistics, at those numbers, and how is the hospital trying to prepare for it?
It's a challenge. We have been planning for this. We've been working as hard as we can with the health department and others. It all depends on volume. You know, it's about how many patients do we get at one time. There is a limit to matter, you know, no matter how much support you have, no matter how much resources. But we are getting as ready for the challenge as we can. In a disaster, usually you have others that can come and help you. In this situation, the rest of the country is in the same situation as we are. We have enough ventilators at present. We have extra, but we also take care of people every day normally. And a lot of times our beds are, half full or even more than half full. So but we can expand. And we have to, again, keep people out of the hospital as best we can. At some point, if we see the volume start to increase, we may stop elective surgeries and things to be able to free up beds for us. But we will see. I mean, it all depends on the volume. But we're all of our people at the hospital, and I think the health department are all here for our community like we've always been, and we are going to take care of it as best we can.
And you have, I guess, what they call, the negative pressure isolation rooms. What are those, and how many do you have?
We have at least 20. They have some that we can expand in the emergency room as well. What they do is they basically pull the air out of the room to ventilate the room so that the air circulates to try to, if there is any virus in the air, to kind of get rid of it rather than it sitting there. We have enough for normal and then some activities, but we will see. When we run out of those beds, we'll use other beds. We'll just keep going until we take care of everybody.
By the way, have you been in touch with or been trying to coordinate with other hospitals in the region? I mean, because obviously, for instance, if you're hit with more patients than, for instance, you can handle, is there the ability to send them to other places?
Well, normally we do have ability to send patients that we can't care for or others can't care for. They send to us. So that system is in place and has always been in place. Like I said before, it may be that there may not be room at other places because they're full too. We'll just work together as we always do. But again, there is a limit.
And what about the staff? I mean, and what kind of training is there? What kind of protective gear will it be dealing with? I mean, they're the people on the front lines.
The fortunate thing is that we have had drills, you heard of Ebola years ago, where we set up a system where we train for this sort of thing. And Corona is not Ebola, but, the same ideas of using the protective gear and the processes that we do to protect ourselves and others are there. So, we're ready. We know how to do it. Our nurses and doctors know how to manage, this type of infectious process.
Because, matter of fact, I read it, some hospitals are sort of trying to establish a series of tiers in which, they're in one tier, there'll be, ICU, which with people, real serious patients, right, and down and so on. Are you doing something similar or...
Right. Well, we're in the process of getting a tent, which a lot of the hospitals have, to put a tent outside of your emergency room as a first line of triage, because we don't want the virus in our building if we can help it, especially if we don't know it's there,
right,
and can spread before we know. That's in the works to be able to screen people there. I say most of the time, most people go home. When they're screened. Now we may send off a test, but we say, okay, the test will come back when we get it. It may be a day or two, but go home and we'll let you know, because again, the gigantic majority of people won't be sick enough to be in a hospital. We'll have to monitor. They'll have to self-monitor to see if things get worse or not. Our testing is really what we want to do. We need to have testing that where we can test somebody just like we do the flu in the hospital and offices and know right away that, do you have it or not? And that's a work in progress as well.
Will you be able to do testing to the hospital, or are you going to need to send it out of the state?
We are trying our darndest to be able to get the materials and the test kits to be able to do it ourselves. Again, everything so far has had to be sent and has to be screened. So, you know, again, we have to have permission to be able to send the test. We can't say, you know, to send them all because it will overwhelm the system that is currently there. The system is gearing up, but it is taking time. And but we do need to know, because it's uncomfortable to see somebody and say, okay, we'll test you and, you know, we'll get back to you. And they go home and what do I do? If we can tell them you got it or you don't, you know, because you know, isolation is a problem. You know, people have to live. And if you don't have it, we wouldn't have you sit for 14 days cooped up. And that's a big disruption to everybody's life. So we'd like to know. And if you do have it, we really like to know that so that we can be prepared that if you do get sicker. So that is a work in progress. Again, our country's behind on this. We're trying to catch up, but we're doing the best we can.
What about in terms of cost? In fact, there was an issue on Capitol Hill yesterday.
Right.
I think one congressional member said something could be $1,000. I don't know whether or not. What does that mean in terms of the person who's coming in? And maybe they might not have insurance. They might say, well, I can't afford this, so I don't want it. I mean, how do you deal with that? Are you just going to test everybody? And
We deal with it like we do every day. You come to the emergency room, we will treat you, no matter if you have insurance, money, whatever. You know, that's not the problem right now. We got to take care of our people and help them, not spread it to others. So we'll worry about that later. But we see people. You don't have to, you know, pay before you're seen in the emergency room. We
right.
see you. That's not our issue right now. You know, we shouldn't be thinking about that. We should be thinking about taking care of our community.
Well, you think I mean, anybody comes in that they, you know, if they don't have insurance or something, that they
we still
shouldn't have
you.
To pay, and they shouldn't have to. Do you think they should have to pay for it?
Again, we'll deal with
issue,
that
but,
later. You know,
yeah.
But like I say, and the hope is that the government will be able to support
yeah.
our needs for that. But again, it's about people, not about money, right now.
So how does this compare to other outbreaks of viruses?
Everyone's unique, I guess, you know,
yeah.
and again, we've had experience just in a few months in the world, you know, this hasn't been the fifth time we've seen this. So we are learning on the fly, and we're learning from other countries. The United States is the United States. And again, we don't have that many cases, thank goodness yet. But we're learning from each one, and all that information is being, you know, forwarded to everybody. We get stuff constantly, and that's part of the frustration, is because what we tell you right this minute, tonight may be different, you know, because we'll have more information. But I will commend the governor and the state of Maryland in being very aggressive. A lot of people may say, oh, we're overreacting. You get one chance at this. If you don't put into place the things that we're doing now, we will suffer later. So it could be an inconvenience for people. And hopefully it turns out that it's not so bad in Maryland. But we are trying our darndest to make sure that's happening and not, you know, wait and see. Because when you wait and see and it starts really, you know, gearing up here, it's too late. So, you know, again, we need everybody's help.
How does this compare to, either H1N1, but, you know, most people, a lot of people are aware of the 1918 influenza,
right.
which had, I think, about 2% death rate is
right.
what the estimate was. How do you compare this at this, well, from what we know right now, because we don't know a lot, with,
right.
say, those kinds of outbreaks?
Well, again, there's different estimates on the fatality rate for the COVID-19. Regular flu that we're dealing with today, and there is quite a bit of flu still in our community, it's about 0.1% mortality rate. Dr. Fauci on TV, you know, just today, you know, it's maybe it's 10 times that. We don't know. We're thinking it could be 2 to 5%. Part of our problem is, again, we're using statistics from other parts of the world. If you don't test, you don't know how many people have it. We know how many people die of it, how many people get hospitalized. But people out in the community, a lot of people are going to have it and never know they had it because it could just be a mild illness. So you don't know the denominator as accurately as of that we would like as far as how many people have it and then how many die of it, and that's what your percentage comes from, right?
Right.
So we just don't know that denominator accurately yet. Down the road, we'll know, you know, but right now we do feel like it's a lot worse than the flu. Again, with no specific treatment to fight it, that's a problem.
What kind of risk is there of getting it? We've been told that it's low, but you know, some people have said that a few weeks ago before a lot of other,
right?
At least, I mean, either one of you, I mean, is it low? I mean, what do you think, Olivia?
Well, again, it's all about exposure. You know, how many people that have you come in contact with that have the virus, whether you know it or not? How many surfaces have you touched that have the virus on it? I saw just recently that the virus apparently in hard surfaces can live for 3 days. You know, so you could have touched a doorknob from somebody that walked into the room an hour ago and touched it, and then touch your face, touch your mouth, you know, your eyes, and get it that way, and had no clue that there was anybody sick around you. So again, that's where we have to be very careful. We have to clean surfaces, especially surfaces that are used like doorknobs or handles and chair arms and all those things that people touch a lot. Wash your hands constantly. Don't touch your face, which try not to touch your face. It's very hard, but try not to touch your face. Cover your nose and mouth when you sneeze and cough. Don't do it in your hands. Do it in tissues or in your elbow and then wash your hands. All those things make a big difference, and really that's what we got to have our people do.
One other final question. So the issue of masks, how effective are they? What kind of masks should people be thinking about if they think about them at all?
Yeah. Well, it's not really recommended for someone to wear a mask if they're not having symptoms. They probably will be asked to put on like a procedural type mask if they're coming into an office with symptoms. And they have decreased some of the guidance for what types of masks are needed by healthcare workers if they're collecting specimens to be sent off for testing or doing procedures that might cause aerosolization of the virus, from N95 masks that are fitted to procedural masks. And that is, they would wear the N95s if they were doing those procedures, but just in general care of the patient, being in the same room, the procedural mask would be fine. And that's to kind of help the supply of the N95s, which a lot of places, if they didn't have any, are having a hard time ordering them, and saving those resources for when they're truly needed.
Mm-hmm. And the N95, they're described as respirator masks. What's that mean? What do they look like?
It's just the way the mask is made. It's much more, we'll say, powerful on its preventing mm-hmm. particles from getting into you, as opposed to, like she says, a procedural mask, the cone mask, or the mask you see that tie. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all about blockage of transmission. So again, people that have the virus, or we think they have the virus, we put a mask on to try to prevent them from spreading it to others. The people that are taken care of, people with known corona, that they wear masks. The general population is not needed.
We've been speaking with Dr. Charles Silvey. He's a chief medical officer for Peninsula Regional Medical Center. Also, Olivia Butler. She's a program manager for communicable diseases and here from Wicomico County Health Department. Appreciate you both stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. It's election time, and for voters in Maryland's 1st Congressional District, there's one candidate who's returning to the field. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Allison Galbraith is taking her second shot at winning the Democratic primary to challenge Republican incumbent Andy Harris. Galbraith made a run 2 years ago and came in second behind Jesse Colvin in the Democratic primary. But much has changed for the impeachment of the president and contentious presidential race. And we have her in our studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So why make the second run?
So since the 2018 election, I stayed involved. This is my backyard. I do care. I ran for party officer, and I was elected the second vice chair of the Maryland Democratic Party. My focus there has been making sure that our party is treating the rural areas of the state with the respect and appreciation that they deserve. Just because we're less densely populated doesn't mean we're any less important. When you look at the numbers, some of the voter registration numbers and GOP outpacing the Democrats through the 12 counties in District 1 suggest eventually Maryland goes purple. Or maybe you've seen the polling showing Hogan beating Senator Van Hollen. And I looked at the longer, bigger picture implications of what would happen if we're not competing here with a solid race, with a solid contender every single cycle. And eventually it just erodes into not being able to win any race anywhere on the ballot that's touching District 1. That to me was horrifying. Beyond that, Harris does not deserve a free pass. He's never deserved a free pass. He's not doing his job, even in the most basic sense. So we just need, he deserves to have a challenger. He deserves to have somebody who will go after him on his record.
Well, how do you compare, for instance, you bring up Hogan. How do you compare Hogan to Harris?
They're a totally different beast. Harris is not even remotely reasonable on basically any issue. He might tell you he is. He might say in his social media, I voted for this or this is why I did this. But when you actually know what he's doing, he is flat out lying to people about the impacts of his policies and what they would do.
Such as?
He touts health care, for instance, all the time. He's a doctor. He's an obstetric anesthesiologist. He talks about healthcare all the time and how he's expanding healthcare and he's making it cheaper. What he is doing is making it easier for the health insurance companies to deny people based on, again, what we had seen before, pre-existing conditions, gender, all sorts of things. I mean, I got into politics because I asked him about gender rate hikes in 2017 and said, I'm a small business owner. I started this small business because my mom had had a series of strokes. I'd been laid off. Employers don't want to deal with caregiving obligations, this and that. And the only thing, I was in the middle of a divorce, had lost access to my spouse's health insurance policy. The only reason I could own a business at that point in my life, and it was the only thing giving me the flexibility to take care of my mother, especially as a single mom, was that the Affordable Care Act said you can't deny people based on gender. They used to charge women 30 to 80% more for the same policy, which didn't even cover maternity. And you can't deny based on pre-existing conditions, which in my case was pregnancy. I'd had a child. That was it. And I finally meet the guy after 4 months, and I ask him if he'll vote against gender rate hikes, any legislation for ACA replacement, which allows for gender rate hikes. And he looks at me and he says, well, I don't think most people would mind if women paid a little more for health insurance. I don't know if he knows that most people are women or that women are people. It raises some questions. But you look at his legislation, 30% of what he co-sponsors is attacking women's reproductive rights. So you want us to have all these kids, but you're also going to charge us more for health insurance on the basis that we're able to have all of these kids. And then you're going to go and do things like cut the food stamp program. You're gonna dilly-dally on making sure that CHIP is funded. You know, it's obscene, the things that he does. But the way that he sells it, his messaging, if you're not digging below the surface, you wouldn't see that there's actually an issue there. 30 to 40% of his time on top of that is spent actually pushing for legislation, which chips away at people's ability to receive health care. You know, in a rural area in particular, and there are plenty of rural areas in District 1, some areas you don't even have an urgent care center. People are ending up in the ER for an ear infection, having to drive 45 minutes, things like that. Basic economics says they're going to price gouge you if you only have one area in one place that you can go in a very large area because it's supply and demand. And he ought to know that if they're the party of, private industry is best for this. There are some things where profit motive is simply not aligned with what's good for people.
One of the things, by the way, he touts, and we saw it again this session as well, that he supports full funding for the Chesapeake Bay Restoration Program, something that the president has often tried to either zero out or certainly cut to the point of almost extinction. So he can come and say, you know, I support the environment, I support the bay. Do you disagree with that?
I think his record on environment is slightly better than his record on other areas, which is often that he totally opposes what's best for the people that he represents. With regard to the Bay funding, I think it would be insane for him not to sign on to these letters where you have the other Democrats that represent us in Congress all signed on saying protect the Bay when he is the representative with the Bay in the district. But his record on environment in general is not good. It's not good. They want to roll back these EPA regulations. I can't recall exactly, but he may be one of the handful of people who thinks the EPA simply shouldn't exist. What do you think happens if we're letting all this runoff get into the bay? And ultimately, you're causing as much of a problem as you are throwing funding at it, even if you do sign on to the letter.
So how do you think you're going to win over conservative voters? I mean, this is a very conservative district. It was actually drawn that way by Democrats in redistricting. A lot of folks are going to be listening to you and saying, well, look, you know, I've always voted Republican and I will continue to do so.
I'm a small business owner, and what I do professionally is consult for the Department of Defense in acquisition streamlining. So it is my job to tell the federal government how to run their programs faster or cheaper, how to get around bureaucratic red tape. I understand fiscal responsibility, if not professionally, certainly as a single mother, where you have to learn how to stretch a dollar sometimes. I want us to have responsible use of our taxpayer dollars. And that does not include, say, voting against hurricane relief funding for your own district. That does not include cutting resources for your schools. That does not include cutting access to things like birth control. People can say, well, I don't want to pay for it. But for every dollar spent in providing free access to contraceptives, you save six. We need policies that make sense. So when I went to grad school, University of Maryland, it was for public policy. I believe in best practices in public policy. I believe in ethics, integrity, and responsible government, ethical government. Also, I believe that representatives need to remember that they work for everybody. They don't work for the hardline wing of their party. They don't work for one party or the other party. A large part of their job is constituent services, and people just want to know that they have one of them who's willing to advocate for them and listen, whether they agree with you or not. And I'm happy to do that.
I'm going to turn to some of the constituencies, the farming community, the agriculture community. They're fairly conservative in terms of certainly their politics. How does your assessment of what Harris has done in terms of his policies, and what would you be doing differently?
Well, he voted against the farm bill, for one. But I'd go out and I'd talk to them, you know, and try and understand what are your specific concerns? What is it that you need? Are your small family farms being taken advantage of in the contract structures that you have with the larger farms? What is it that you need from us? Government ought to work for the person who can't afford to give a cent to a politician, not the person who is able to max out. You know, I'm for the little guy. I would go out and talk to the small family farm, say, how can I help? What can we do? Another part of my job professionally is acquisition reform and how we do contracts. And I know how contracts should be properly structured. I know how contracts can be structured to exploit a smaller company that has no other option. What can we do to help you with those things? What can we do truly understanding what the impacts of the environmental regulations would be on you. How can we help you with that if we say you need to implement a more sustainable tactic for your farming techniques, things like that. And making sure that they know that somebody's there to listen, that we're going to get their input on everything, that we're going to take the time to understand the issues and do our due diligence. I think at the most basic level, we should be able to expect representatives to do their jobs, to read bills before they vote for them, to not just take a party stance. I consider it irresponsible. I think a lot of people would appreciate that.
Are you comfortable with the large poultry operations, large farming, but particularly poultry, as opposed to the folks who contract? Is there something you would change in relationship to them?
I will tell you flat out that I do not know everything about all of these issues. What I can promise is that I'm very good at problem solving, and I'm very good at pulling in the experts who do know these things and bringing people to the table to talk about them. And I think that we would have to sit down and have a conversation about what's going on here, what the impacts are, who needs help the most, and what the best way to resolve those issues are.
Because the reason why I ask is that you mentioned the fact that talking about people who have contracts, who are small farmers, a small business, as it were, that is certainly the motif, as it were, of the current poultry industry, in which there are a lot of farmers, a lot of growers of poultry there out there. They have these individual contracts with large folks who produce poultry, and sometimes there's inequity, sometimes there's not. Are you concerned about that?
Absolutely. So that was brought to my attention, and that was what I was referring to with the contracts where it was not fairly structured to benefit the small family farms. Everybody ought to be able to put in a hard day's work and earn a living and have enough money to get by and to be able to retire in peace and comfort with dignity. If we don't have structures of our contracts, if we don't have, and that's broader than that, it goes to all employment. If workers don't have those things available to them, then that is something that where we ought to be stepping in and making sure that the little guy is protected, that the person who is at a disadvantage in negotiating these things is protected, and make sure that people have what they need to get by, and that they're not being taken for a ride, I guess.
By the way, do you favor then that more unionization for people who are working in places?
I absolutely support collective bargaining rights. I think that we need to stop chipping away at our unions. I think that we need to make sure that labor is protected. I think that we need to hear them out and make sure that we're backing up our workers in terms of negotiating what kind of benefits they have, making sure that they have a safe working environment, making sure that they're protected in the way that they need. I will say, in a perfect world, employers would do these things and behave responsibly across the board, and there wouldn't be a need for it. But realistically, until that happens, if it ever happens, then you have to have unions.
I want to turn to the watermen, and certainly the Chesapeake Bay itself. A lot of local watermen, of course, feel put upon because of a lot of the restrictions that are going on. On the other hand, we have serious situation with Pennsylvania and the flow that's coming down the Susquehanna River. What would you be doing to try to, on the one hand, balance what the watermen need in terms of being able to harvest oysters and crabs as opposed to environmental restrictions?
Well, I think that we need to... pollution doesn't respect state boundaries. That is something that belongs up at the federal level and to be addressed up at the federal level. With regard to the watermen, you go out there and you talk to them and say, which regulations are you concerned about? Certainly pollution in the areas that they're trying to go crabbing or fishing, whatever it is, that's not going to help them. Nobody wants to be concerned about the quality of the food that they're eating. Nobody wants to have those issues. We also need to make sure that they have the visas that they need for the workers for crab picking, things like that.
Speaking of immigration, what's your feeling about it? It's obviously a hot issue nationally, certainly important here on the shore, whether it's farming industry or more personally, perhaps the tourist industry. Where you are on that? What would you lobby for?
What would I respond? Oh, man, that's such a...
I mean, it's a tough one, but I mean...
Can't we talk about abortion or guns or something? Let's see. Well, I think that what we've been doing to immigrant communities is abhorrent, unethical, and it's sad. It's very sad. We need to have more responsible policies, which are based in basic human decency and compassion. And then we shouldn't have local law enforcement operating as an extension of ICE. That kind of thing shouldn't be happening. People shouldn't be concerned to report a crime that happened in their community because of their immigration status. We need to make it easier for people to become citizens of the United States. I mean, if people want to come here and serve and pay taxes, what is the problem? These mass deportations are economic insanity. I mean, we are dependent on these people for a number of things. They contribute a huge, huge amount of money each year in the country. But beyond that, going back to what Harris spends his time on with the reproductive rights, their immigration policies, the xenophobic immigration policies, are driving down our birth rates in the country, which is then causing problems across the board and encouraging them to push these other crazy policies where they, for instance, have redefined your hormonal birth control as an abortion, which is ridiculous. There are plenty of reasons to take birth control that are not specifically associated with birth, you know. Women need to have access to the drugs that they need. I think they understand that this is sort of key to equality. And the broader impacts of what we've been doing with our immigration policy, it's bad. And it's a big web of issues. The other thing is with regard to climate change. If we're not addressing climate change, then we are going to have more people trying to come here. You know, we need to be responsible with those types of things so that we can preemptively do something to address this instead of people crossing the border asking for refugee status and us violating their rights, which is what's happening right now.
Well, as a matter of fact, here off the coast, in particular off of Ocean City, there is controversial proposals for wind farms, at least two of them anyway. Coastal folks, particularly in Ocean City, say they're concerned that they're going to be too close, that perhaps they don't want them at all. But obviously, wind is a key element, for instance, in dealing with climate change. Where are you in terms of whether or not, A, these things should be there, and B, what process, if there is, to be needed for those things to be established?
The wind farms?
Yep. Off the coast. Because there are Ocean City officials that say, we don't want them.
Well, you know, there are other areas who have had similar projects, and you can see them, and it's about the size of a thumbnail on the ocean. And they've not had any dip in their tourism. It's in fact, in some ways, a draw to those communities and has brought in more money. Also, there's obviously the environmental impacts, the economic impacts, it brings in jobs, and we need to be transitioning to cleaner energy sources. And would you rather have an oil rig out there because Harris just barely stopped them from allowing to drill out there? And that was because of an uproar from his constituents. I'm surprised he listened because he normally doesn't. But I support the wind farm projects. Certainly, the constituents themselves, the area, the local residents should have a say in that, and representatives should be there to listen. But in this particular situation, Harris is going and messing with a project that Maryland already approved. I mean, this is just wasting money at this point over sort of silly things. And when you look into why is he doing it? Well, it's about money. It's all about money. It's not about who he works for. It's not about the areas that he represents or what's best for them. It's not about anything that's good for us long term. It's about who's paying him.
What a turn to foreign policy. We got a series of issues going on in terms of, and particularly the Russians. And as you know, we've had recently, there's a report that the Russians favor Donald Trump. We're looking at possible intervention by the Russians into our election. What kind of relationship do you think there should be? And you, as a congressional member, you'll have to deal with this between the United States and Russia.
Between the United States and Russia. Well, certainly not one where they're interfering in our elections or we're interfering in theirs. This all comes down to it goes back to integrity, ethics, responsible government, rule of law. Are we going to do something about this or are we not going to do something about this? I mean, I guess it's clear we're not going to do a whole lot about it right now. We can't. But maybe we need a way to take the people who refuse to do their jobs and do something about it out of office. Maybe we need anti-corruption legislation. Maybe we need to go about it that way and say, look, you know, demonstrate basic competence and decency, integrity in your job, and you can stay there. Otherwise, you can't be a representative anymore. I mean, our democracy is at stake. This is a bigger thing. If we can't trust in our electoral process, that is a massive, massive problem. You know, we ought to have more people voting, not more people asking whether their vote matters at all or if we can just buy an election or if another country can buy an election. And it's very discouraging.
By the way, how do you view U.S. military involvement abroad? We have perhaps some kind of resolution perhaps coming with Afghanistan, but we have troops all around the world. Do you favor more military engagement? You think that we need to withdraw? What, I mean, is there a tripwire for, say, yeah, I'm going to vote to send military guys?
I will say this. I was married to a combat veteran for over a decade. I've raised children through a deployment where I had to explain to a 2.5-year-old who didn't understand where daddy was, dad's going to come home when I don't really know. And the only thing he would ever tell me is, look, I work on Blackhawks. They'll protect the Blackhawks because the Blackhawks are worth $30 million. Now, a person to the military is worth, what, $400,000, something like that it was back then. And I also have worked for Department of Defense myself as a contractor, a consultant for 10, 11 years now. We need to evaluate those things on a case-by-case basis. There are situations where it is appropriate for us to send some troops in, but we need to be smart about how we're going about that. You know, long-term presence in a lot of these regions is not necessarily a good idea. We shouldn't have people going over for 4, 5, 6 different deployments. It's impossible for them. There are long-lasting implications to their mental health, physical health. It impacts families. And it blows a ton of money. What are we doing? You know, you need to be more careful with it. So I certainly wouldn't favor military intervention unless I saw it as absolutely necessary to, say, maintain peace in a region. And I would say that we should go in there with international partners and not be the only ones that are in there alone.
Well, let me stay along those lines. One of the most difficult foreign policy areas for certainly the Obama administration, certainly again now for the Trump administration, although they seem to have now made some decision, was Syria and what to do. What side was anyone on? And we had conflicting situations with our allies, the Turks, for example. Is that a place, kind of place we should be, get ourselves involved with militarily?
Well, what did they do the last time that they found? The last time there was a chemical weapons attack, they struck 3 facilities,
right?
Correct?
Right.
I would say that was actually the right call. I mean, it wasn't populated areas as research and development facilities. If you're not dealing with these chemical weapon precursors, then they ultimately turn into chemical weapons, which are going to be used on their own people. I mean, that you cannot leave unaddressed. And we do have responsibilities to deal with biological and chemical warfare internationally. We have international agreements with regard to that. So we need to honor those and make sure our allies know that we're going to keep our word. We're going to step up to the plate when we need to. And I do think that it was appropriate that we went in there with international allies and did that and didn't do it in a vacuum. And that it was very targeted, very limited strike just to get at where they were keeping these chemical weapon precursors.
Well, along those lines, do you agree then with the Trump administration in terms of pulling back in terms of our involvement abroad? How much commitment, or do you think we need to reassess the kind of involvement that we've had?
That is the type of thing I would want to pull in the military advisors and you know, local people who understand those issues very, very well and understand and assess on a case-by-case basis.
Well, can't get away without talking about impeachment.
Of course not.
We just went through that. And, of course, the president was impeached by the House and acquitted, as it were, by the Senate. All of this stuff, though, was along certainly party lines. What did you make of that in terms of how government functions? We ran an essay not too long ago questioning whether or not the courts needed some other way to adjudicate some of these cases so that they could move more quickly, as opposed to finding the Democrats skirting that and having to say, well, we have to move on because we can't wait for the courts, for example. What does it say about how our government works in this 18th century document we know as the Constitution?
Sorry, can you rephrase that?
So what is your impression of how, from what we've seen of the impeachment process, in all of its flaws, what do you think it says about how we govern?
I think it says that we don't have responsible government anymore, that we don't have rule of law anymore, that people who distrust government have every reason to distrust government. So divided, so partisan. Some things should not be a question of party. My bachelor's degree was in philosophy with a focus in ethics. I believe in truth. I believe in logic. I believe in things that make sense. Even in the Nixon era, we at least had people who were willing to acknowledge on both sides of the aisle that something was wrong. Now, I've not personally read the Mueller report, right? I'm not going to tell you that I have any reason to not believe it, that I have any reason to believe it. I'm inclined to think that they did their due diligence in making sure that they documented all of those things very thoroughly. But something I can tell you is that if Andy Harris is commenting on that report within 3 minutes of it being released to Congress, he didn't read it. He doesn't know what's in it. You know? He doesn't care what the truth is. And what was it, Amash, who broke away and said, this is absolutely right, that I am horrified by what's in this report, that there's no reason to question it, and that crimes were committed. Just if this were private industry, if it were anything else, if it were private industry, these people would have been fired for gross incompetence by now.
By the way, are you concerned about what occurred with the Ukraine situation, with the offering, as it were, it appears anyway, of assistance in term and a meeting, White House meeting in return for some kind of announcement of investigation? I mean, what does it say about where we are? And perhaps a broader question about this particular president has certainly broken a whole set of norms, and yet this government, this Constitution, doesn't seem to be able to rein them in. Is it just completely broke?
Let's go back. Well, maybe. But one of my biggest things, going back to my always caring about ethics, my always caring about things making sense, is I think probably the number one thing that I would do in Congress is implement anti-corruption legislation and to in a perfect world, you know, and you'd hope people would agree with this, an overhaul of our campaign system. And not just finance, making it easier, you know, public financing of campaigns, making it easier for people to run. You shouldn't be able to buy an election either. What you're trying to do in Congress is not about how much money you can raise. What you're trying to do in Congress is how responsibly can you spend a taxpayer's dollar. Our electoral system is giving you people who have the exact opposite skill set. I would like to cap the amount of funding that you can spend on an election. I think that's the only thing that's going to allow everyday people to get in there. And diversity of perspective is important because people prioritize. This is just human nature, basic human nature. People prioritize the issues that they know best, whether it's personal to them because they lived it or it's an issue with their mother. Case in point, Barbara Mikulski pushed some elder care legislation, but she did not do it until her own father got sick. There are certain types of people who are going to have issues running for office. It's going to be harder for them, more barriers for them. For instance, in my case, I'm a single mother. I got into this, you know, shortly after my own mother had passed away. My dad is not in great health. It's all these things coming at me, you know, in life, and I'm certainly not independently wealthy. You know, I'm not going to be able to go out there and buy an election. But I understand issues that average working Americans are living, whereas somebody who is a millionaire and is just going to pay for home care and these things are not a concern, does not know what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck, is going to prioritize the things that are an issue to them. And it's not going to be the same set of issues. So perspective and your experience are dictating your priorities, and your priorities are dictating what you're going to go in there and fight for. We need diversity in the House of Representatives, the House closest to the people in particular, because if your perspective is not in there, you're not being served. And we don't need to look any farther than the people who've been left behind by the government all these years to see that this is true, or what a very homogenous group of people who share the same similar set of issues are going to focus on while ignoring everything else, because maybe in their experience, they're not even aware this problem exists. That's not serving everybody. We need to make sure that anybody who would make a good member of Congress, a good representative, any level of elected office, as a matter of fact, has the opportunity and the tools and resources that they need in order to do that. And we need also to make sure that our electorate is better informed, because most people keep asking me, how does Andy Harris win? I canvass door to door all the time. I've met maybe one person who likes him, and that was regardless of party, if they knew what he was doing. And the only conclusion that I can draw based on that is that most people don't know who their representative is, never mind what they do. I mean, even my local Republicans are saying, oh, well, you know, I'll vote for Hogan, but that guy's awful. We need to make sure that people are invested in our government, that people understand why they need to participate, that people understand the importance of their vote. We need to end things like gerrymandering, which make you question whether your vote matters at all. Every vote should matter. Maybe we need to look at ranked choice voting instead of our current primary systems. Look at different ways of doing things and overhauling it, and also having ethics legislation saying, hey, you can't own millions of dollars of stocks in an industry you're elected to go regulate. You know, this is this is public service. It's not a get-rich-quick scheme. These people need to remember who they work for. Maybe we need to make it easier to get rid of some of them, too, if they don't want to do their jobs. Clean out your war chest every couple of years.
Well, we've been speaking with Allison Galbraith. She is running for Congress in the 1st District, and she hopes to challenge Republican incumbent Andy Harris. Second time around, we'll see how it all goes. I appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva